Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Sports Tonight on BSL Radio. Join Rob Shields and Mike Weber as they talk about the Baltimore Orioles, Baltimore Ravens, University of Maryland Terrapins, and more. Be part of the show. Call us at 347-215-8391.
Welcome to Sports Tonight with Rob and Mike. Mike Weber here with Rob Shields. I'm pretty excited for this show. One of my favorite topics every year, the Baseball Hall of Fame. We just had the election results come in yesterday. You know, very strong class. Four guys got in, which I think with the voters we have is about as good as you could expect, really, here. So you have Randy Johnson and Pedro Martinez got in, obvious guys, no doubt about it, players, no steroid suspicions or anything there. Then you have John Smoltz, and to Rob and myself and a lot of people, interesting guy to get in on his first ballot while some of these other guys have to wait. And then Craig Biggio got in. Last year he missed by like 2 votes, I think it was. So he's a guy who, you know, is also, to me, like maybe somewhat borderline, but I think he's a deserving candidate. So all four guys, I think we both think are deserving. It's, you know, very interesting, though, the guys who did not make it, and just the whole process here with the Hall of Fame, and, you know, that certain guys obviously get left out, and, you know, and there's the 10-player limit. So we'll get into all sorts of stuff like that. So, Rob, first off, what is your reaction to the election results?
Well, I think all four guys who got in, they deserve to be in. I think this is the first time since 1955 that more than three guys were voted in this, at least in this part of the process. So, and I think it's only happened 4 or 5 times that 4 or more guys have been voted in at once, with 5 being the most that's ever gone in. So, like you said, this is probably about as good as it's going to get. Now, there were 12 to 15 guys or so on this ballot this year that should all be into the Hall of Fame. You know, and there might be a couple other guys that you could argue are kind of borderline and, you know, maybe should be in, but, you know, you could understand it could take a little while. So my issue isn't more with who got in, but, you know, with not only who didn't get in, but, like, how far away they are. You know, for example, you know, we've talked about Mike Mussina quite a bit in our Hall of Fame conversations. I mean, I think he went up to 24 and change percent of the vote. I think last year he was like 20, 22, somewhere in there. So, I mean, it's very little jump there. And when you hear so many people talking about the Hall of Fame, almost everybody you hear says, well, Mussina should be in, Tim Raines should be in, Curt Schilling should be in. But, you know, those are the guys who are the vocal guys that we hear on the ESPNs and Fox News, Fox Sports, and, you know, things like that. So it's kind of like, you know, there's just so many people, for whatever reason, that don't share that. And, you know, like you said in the opening, I want to know what the justification is to how you allow Smoltz into the Hall of Fame on the first ballot. Not that he doesn't deserve it, but that a guy like Mussina is, you know, he has 24% of the vote. He needs another 50%, or actually 51%, to get in. And it's like, I mean, he's not even close yet. You know, if you take a stat like, you know, WAR off of Baseball Reference, Mussina's was 82 and change, and Smoltz is 66.5. Now, I know, you know, we've talked about how WAR does not, you know, it's not as good as it should be to relief pitchers. I get that. I understand. Even if you want to say, okay, give Smoltz another 10 or 12 WAR, Mussina's still more. So it's a little – and plus Mussina also did it in the American League. He did it in the American League East. He did it with the DH and all that kind of – so it's just it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I'd love to hear justification from the guys. I'm sure we would hear stuff like, well, you know, Smoltz was in the playoffs very often. You know, look, I mean, the bottom line is he was seen more. You know, Mussina kind of suffers from the idea of, well, you weren't a flashy guy. You know, you didn't talk to the media a lot. You know, your face wasn't always in front of the camera and stuff like that. And I don't care what any voter says, that hurts them. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of yesterday listening to Mike and Mike Greenberg, who enjoys talking about baseball and the Hall of Fame and stuff, and he was saying, you know, he would have voted in eight guys, and he was saying that Smoltz was, you know, a no doubt about it. And one thing that he said is, to make the Hall of Fame, you shouldn't have to look at somebody's statistics. You should just be able to close your eyes and say, yep, that guy's a Hall of Famer. And I think some people, or most people, if that is their criteria, and I absolutely believe that there are a lot of writers where that's the criteria, I can see why Mussina hasn't gotten in, because I don't think people realize how good he was.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of like sighing over here. That's like the worst criteria to me.
Yeah,
this guy, you just know he's a Hall of Famer. You don't have to look at anything. I mean, ridiculous. I guess that's how we end up with, you know, like Jim Rice as a Hall of Famer. I don't know. But it's really dumb, I think. You have to look at what these guys actually accomplished and not just, like, think of their prime or what you saw in whatever percentage of the baseball of his career that you actually watched, which for the vast majority of these guys and for us as well, it's a very low percentage, unless we're talking about someone that, in our case, played for the Orioles, since we're Orioles fans, or that, you know, a reporter covered that specific team. Otherwise, you know, I mean, I don't really care how big of a baseball fan you are. You're not going to see that much of these guys playing. So, I mean, I guess you can be a fanatic now with the internet and all the ways you can actually watch baseball. And, you know, if you want to watch basically every start that, say, Clayton Kershaw makes, you can do that. But, you know, I don't think that was going on for most of these guys, that especially the ones that are like, oh, you don't have to look at anything. And you know, Mike Greenberg, baseball is not his favorite sport, I don't believe. I mean, I don't listen to Mike and Mike as much as you do, Rob. But I think it's probably second or third, I don't know. But I don't think he's, you know, a baseball fanatic. So, you know, it's just kind of silly to me, the whole thing. By the way, should have mentioned at the top, we have Nick Cofardo on from the Boston Globe coming on about 13 minutes. He's a guy who has a vote, and he used all 10 slots, so I applaud him for that. He's not someone who is going to be anti-PEDs, except for he mentioned if you failed a test after they actually started testing and they implemented the no steroid rules and they really enforced it. So after that, like Alex Rodriguez, for example, then I guess he will not vote for that guy. But, you know, he has Bonds and Clemens on his ballot, for instance. So he voted for Smoltz, did not vote for Schilling or Mussina. So we'll ask him why, as far as that's concerned. We also have Jonah Carey on from Grantland in about half hour. So, you know, excellent writer there, Jonah Carey. So excited for those two guests. But, yeah, also, you know, this stuff like, you know, this guy's a Hall of Famer. I mean, there has to be a borderline somewhere, and there has to be some sort of line. And any guy that's roughly around that line, I don't know how you can just declare if he's a Hall of Famer or not based on, well, you just know he's a Hall of Famer or not. If you just do that, then, yeah, obviously Randy Johnson and Pedro get in. But I'm not sure, like, why or how you come to the conclusion of some of these other guys. It's just these guys, you have to dig deeper. You don't have to dig deeper for Randy Johnson or Pedro Martinez. You do if you're like me and you want to, like, rank these guys, like, compared to other, like, all-time greats, then yes. Or if there was, like, the Bill Simmons Hall of Fame pyramid, which, you know, I really like that idea. So if there was, you know, the top level and then the level below that and so on and so forth, then you could be like, all right, well, what level is Randy Johnson in? Jonah Carey, for instance, argued that Randy Johnson is the greatest left-handed starting pitcher ever. So then you have to dig deeper. You can't just be like, oh, I just don't have to look at anything. I just know he's the best or he's not the best. Andy Koufax was the best or Lefty Grove or whatever, Steve Carlton. You have to actually look at some numbers, even if they're just the basic numbers, which, you know, for pitchers, I think is, I mean, as long as we're not, you know, relying too much on wins, is not too bad if you're looking at ERA. But, I mean, obviously, ERA plus would be much better because it adjusts for context, league, and era. So someone like Sandy Koufax doesn't get the ridiculous boost for playing in like one of the greatest pitching environments of the live ball era. The Smoltz thing is befuddling because I think he's worthy. I think it's for two reasons. He pitched for the Braves in probably the greatest rotation in history with Maddux and Glavine as the main two other guys, and then there usually was a good fourth guy along with those three. So it's probably the best rotation ever, or at least right at the top of the list. And they were on TV all the time. They made it to the postseason. So that, as well as the whole, he was a closer, a very good closer for a while, so he kind of have the quasi-Dennis Eckersley type of resume, even though Eckersley really wasn't that great of a starter, and he was a much better reliever than Smoltz. He wasn't a reliever for much longer than Smoltz. But you kind of got that thing going where you're like, oh, well, you can get all these saves combined with the wins. And then Mussina, if he would have hung around, let's say he has 270 career wins. If he had three mediocre years to finish his career, and he won 20 games his last year, but let's just say he pitched three more years, but it was like mediocre pitching, and he gets the 300, he's in the Hall of Fame by now, which makes no sense. Like, which reward him for mediocre years? That's like kind of like Craig Biggio. The sabermetric type guys wouldn't care about this, but the 3,000 hits, he got 3,000 hits by being kind of not good. I mean, not kind of, just not good. Flat out not good his last 2 years, especially the last year. He kind of sucked. So let's reward him for that. Like, that's what pushes him over. Like, sucky play pushes him over into the Hall of Fame. And Mike Mussina, if he got stuck around, got 300, then he gets in the Hall of Fame. Curt Schilling, I don't get that one. I mean, if we're loving postseason play, memorable moments, you know, he's got that more than just about any starting pitcher in recent times. I mean, Smoltz is an excellent postseason pitcher as well. Schilling, even better. And Schilling's accomplishments are tremendous. So yeah, it's very odd that Sean Smoltz actually has more votes than those two guys combined, and then you can throw in, like, Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa's vote totals, and you still don't get the John Smoltz votes. So I don't get it.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, first of all, just looking at a quick basic stat, you know, comparing postseason resumes. So John Smoltz had an ERA in the postseason of like 3.33. Now, some of that obviously came as a reliever, so you would expect his ERA to be better as a reliever. Oh, I'm sorry, I was looking at the wrong thing. His career ERA in the postseason was 2.67, which, you know, he appeared in. He had 14 of the games that he appeared in. He was a reliever. So, you know, very solid numbers, but, you know, not tremendously better than a guy like Mussina. Mussina's was 3-4, but he was a starter the whole time. And he didn't have the luxury of pitching in the National League and in nice park and, you know, good pitcher's parks and that type of stuff. Getting back to what Greenberg was saying about the close your eyes and you know he's a Hall of Famer. One of the things he was talking about was Derek Jeter. And he was saying, you know, if you look at the stats, Craig Biggio is, you know, kind of close to Jeter statistically, which I don't know if that's true or not. That's just what he was saying. But the thing that he said that kind of got me was the difference is Derek Jeter is one of, if not the greatest postseason player of all time. And I don't know exactly what criteria he was using for that, but Derek Jeter in the regular season batted .310, he had a .377 on base, he had a .440 slugging, and an .817 OPS. In the postseason, for his career, he batted .308, he had a .374 on base, a .465 slugging, and an .838 OPS. So he showed a little bit more power in the postseason and obviously a much smaller sampling. So I guarantee you that there are several players in the history of baseball that had several appearances in the postseason and had an OPS of better than .838 and played better than crappy defense, which is exactly what Derek Jeter did. But somebody like Mike Greenberg remembers 10 clutch hits, remembers, oh, my God, he was the captain of the Yankees that went to the postseason every year. therefore he's one of the greatest postseason players ever. That's ridiculous. And that's exactly why looking at statistics is something that you have to do. Because my point was, and I had tweeted this out when he had said that, was essentially you're assuming that the person who's closing their eyes and saying, is this player good enough to be a Hall of Famer, is knowledgeable enough about that player that they can make that assessment without looking at the statistics. And I guarantee you this, there is likely not one writer, not one, that can make that assessment about every player on this ballot, at least of the ones that are deserving, that are borderline or not, that are deserving of at least a thought. There's not one writer out there that can do that without looking at statistics and doing some comparisons and things like that. And that's not a slight at any of the writers. It's exactly what you said. These guys, as much baseball as they watch, they can only watch so much. You know, you've got 15 games going every day for 162 games, and we're talking about for guys for 10, 15-year careers. They just weren't able – you're just not able to see that much. There's not enough time in the day to sit there and watch that many three-hour games. So it's not a fair thing to say that because you're just not knowledgeable enough to be able to make that assessment. So you have to look at statistics. That's why if people were to look at Mussina's stats and see that he's – I think he's top 10 all-time in strikeouts, and he's got a better Hall of Fame resume than Jim Palmer did. Okay, and there's not many people that would probably think that immediately off the top of their heads, but he does, and it's just a little ridiculous that there is so much of that type of thinking out there that because there is, though, these are the results that we get in this process, which really, quite frankly, the process is the bigger issue here, and it needs to be totally blown up.
Yeah, and just to add to the Biggio Derek Jeter comment, you know, if you ignore the advanced defensive stats, which a guy like Mike Greenberg I would assume would, Derek Jeter's numbers are considerably better than Craig Biggio's. I guess if you just look at a few select numbers, you can kind of be like, well, they're kind of close, but, you know, even if you just look at hits, like it's like 400 is the difference, which is a pretty decent margin. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess overall, it's not maybe that substantial, but Jeter's, you know, batting average is like 30 points higher, which obviously these guys would generally look at. So offensive war number significantly higher, which would not be looked at, I would guess, by Mike Greenberg. But, you know, I could be mistaken. Again, I don't listen to Mike and Mike too often. So, you know, I agree the process is definitely screwed up. We'll get into that with our guest as well tonight. I mean, the 10 ballot limit is not practical any longer. Maybe it used to make sense, but I think about half of the voters this year actually used all 10 spots, and you have to figure that a fair amount of those people would have used more if they could have. And then there was Buster Olney and a couple other guys who decided not to vote this year at all, just not turn in a ballot because they were basically protesting that, saying, hey, we want to vote for more guys. It's not right for us to say, hey, this guy like Tim Raines or Edgar Martinez or whomever, he's a Hall of Famer to me, but I'm not able to vote for him because my ballot has already reached 10 people. Because, like you said earlier, there's, you know, about 15 guys that you can easily make a case for. So I know, you know, that gets, you know, like the small hall guys like riled up and they're like, oh, they scoff at it and stuff. But, I mean, at this point, the Hall of Fame is what the Hall of Fame is. I mean, I don't know how you can, like, really argue for, like, a very small hall at this point. It's not small at all. You have a lot of guys that aren't deserving. And I'm not even saying you have to go, like, oh, because that guy's in, because, like, Pee Wee Reese is in or whatever, you got to put in so-and-so, Nomar Garcia-Pera. Like, I'm not saying that, but there's guys that are, like, average Hall of Famers, and there's about 15 guys that are roughly equivalent or better than an average Hall of Famer at that position. So you have to, you know, I think you have to just be consistent with that and just keep on going with that process. Now there's the whole PED issue, and both of us are, you know, perfectly fine with, you know, going with the PED guys. I don't know. Do you make any sort of distinction, like our guest that we're about to call up, Nick Cofardo, in terms of you know, having a failed test after they started to do anything in terms of actually punishing players and all that?
I personally would probably still vote for a guy like Palmeiro, and I would vote for A-Rod. However, I wouldn't have a problem. I don't have a problem with that line of thinking, mostly because you're penalizing the player for being an idiot. And I don't necessarily have a problem with that because, you know, for the longest time, see, that's the thing that bothers me a lot about the Bonds and Clemens and all. It wasn't illegal for them to be doing what they were doing. It wasn't against baseball rules. So, you know, that's what kind of that bothers me. So if you want to have that stance, to me, I wouldn't have that stance, but it doesn't bother me as much as some of the other stances, just flat out, no, they cheated the game. Because then that gets back into the whole thing with the greenies and all that kind of stuff, and it guaranteed there were steroid usage in the 60s and 70s and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it bothers me. That's what bothers me more about anything about the PED stuff. They ignore the fact that guys like Hank Aaron and Willie Mays were doing things that are now illegal to do, but yet it's fine that they did it then. So that's the stuff that drives me crazy. The other thing is, if you think a guy is really on the borderline, let's just take Mark McGwire for an example. If you thought Mark McGwire was a borderline guy, and if you think that what steroids did for him was enough to put him over that line, then maybe you say, you know what, I'm not going to vote him in because, you know, he needed something to help him out. I wouldn't necessarily have a problem with that thinking depending on the player. Like, I mean, I know you don't think Sosa should be in the Hall of Fame. He's not a guy that jumps off the page to me either. To me, I might look at him and say, okay, yeah, the steroids was probably the reason that he did what he did. And, you know, he wouldn't be in the Hall of Fame without him, so I'm not going to vote him in. But I think there are very few of those guys.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so we'll take a very short break here. Try to get Nick Cofardo on from the Boston Globe, so stay tuned.
Baltimore Sports and Life is dedicated to the analysis and discussion of the Baltimore Orioles, the Baltimore Ravens, and the University of Maryland. The site has a team of writers providing coverage of those teams and houses live streaming content weekly. Join the conversations at the message board, like BSL on Facebook, and follow BSL on Twitter. BSL is part of 24/7 Networks with Russell Street Report and Utah Street Report. Utah Street Report is a baseball site dedicated to the fans of the Baltimore Orioles. Its mission, our mission, unlike mainstream media, is to deliver fun, intelligence, insight, and opinion for fans, by fans. We'll feel your pain and share your joys as they relate to the O's. Follow the site on Twitter at Utah Street Report. And like the site on Facebook at Orioles 24/7. Utah Street Report is part of 24/7 Networks with Russell Street Report and Baltimore Sports and Life.
All right, welcome back to Sports Tonight with Rob and Mike. We are now being joined by Nick Cofardo from the Boston Globe, also appears on MLB Network. How you doing tonight, Nick?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you?
Very good. Thanks a lot for joining the show tonight. Nick, you do have a Hall of Fame vote, and you know, I read your article in the Boston Globe. You voted for 10 players, including all four that were elected. So what is your reaction to the election results?
Well, you know, I think it went according to plan, and, you know, obviously the Pedro Martinez vote was interesting for me, obviously, having covered him. I thought he would get a little bit more than the 91.9 whatever percent it was. I think there was maybe some little strategy involved with some of the voters this year where they maybe didn't give votes to players they thought would get in so they could devote their vote to players, you know, in this very deep ballot. So maybe that had something to do with it. But there were certainly some interesting trends with the voting. You know, obviously a big rise for Curt Schilling, you know, who went from about 29% to over 39%, and I think that bodes well for him as the ballot thins out next year. And Tim Raines, you know, has a couple more years left on that ballot, and he got up to 55%, and maybe he will also rise and maybe get in over the next couple of years. So those were the big things for me. I still am amazed that Jeff Kent doesn't get great support, 15%. You know, he's got some of these the best second base numbers ever, and for some reason, I don't know if he was overshadowed by Bonds or, you know, maybe he wasn't a great defensive second baseman, but his numbers are certainly worthy of more than 15%.
Yeah, so, Nick, we want to get into some of those players you just mentioned, but before we do, you know, there's been a lot of talk about changing the process here with the voting. And there was a committee, and they're talking about they proposed raising the ballot to 12. What do you think should be done in terms of, if anything, to change the process here?
Yeah, I'm on that committee, and you know, I think we're certainly going to propose a 12. You know, there was some support for more than 12, but I think we felt that you know, we're going to give the Hall of Fame maybe something that they can actually vote in favor of, you know, rather than propose something even beyond 12. And, you know, there was certainly a lot of discussion in our committee about the unlimited ballot, you know, where you just vote for whoever you want to vote for. But we don't think that the Hall of Fame will go for that. They have the ultimate decision on all of those things. So so we're going to try 12 and see if that works. And my personal feeling is that the 10 works for me because, you know, in most years you don't have 10. I mean, we've had a logjam here for a 2-3 year period, but I think that logjam is going to subside very shortly, and in fact as early as next year when, you know, you pretty much have, you know, Ken Griffey Jr., possibly Trevor Hoffman gets in, but you're going to have, you know, that the normal kind of ballot, I think, starting next year again.
Nick, we had Richard Justice on last year around the same time talking about the Hall of Fame, and one of the things that bothers him is that you have a lot of voters that no longer even step foot into a stadium, much less cover baseball, and they're still allowed to vote for this. Does that bother you as a fellow voter?
Yeah, it does. I just don't know how you weed people out. You know, I mean, there's a lot of voters now also who don't cover games, who just kind of, you know, sit back in their living room and write about baseball. So I don't know if actually being physically at the game is you know, matters anymore. You know, it's but I do agree there are people in there, you know, who used to be baseball writers who may now be football writers or basketball writers, and maybe they don't pay attention to the game as much. But there are also people I know who have been retired for a while who are very much into the game and follow it very closely, who deserve to keep their vote. So I just don't know how you actually weed these people out. You know, I don't think you can say, well, if you've not been a baseball writer for 10 years, you don't deserve to vote anymore. Because, you know, those people might be really into the game. So it's hard to really weed those people out, I think. So I don't know what to do about that because I guess you got to take it on a case-by-case basis. And I also know people who are voters who have moved on to other sports who have decided that they shouldn't vote for Hall of Fame or anything. So I kind of hope that there are more of those people out there who eventually decide that they are so far removed from it that they shouldn't vote. But I think I would allow them to do that before I made them do that.
And then what about the guys who I think somebody voted, I think I saw Hal McCoy, or you know, he voted for Aaron Boone, and basically his argument was, well, he was a really nice guy. When you see guys like that get voted, get a vote, Darren Erstad got a vote this year, you know, guys who clearly, mm-hmm. you know, don't have a case – And then you see a guy, and we'll get into Mussina here in a second, but you see a guy like Mussina struggle. He's not even at 25% yet, and, you know, he's a Hall of Famer. So, you know, what do you think about guys who vote for players like that, and especially for reasons like, well, you know, he was a really nice guy to me?
Yeah, of course, Hal is a Hall of Famer himself, so, you know, so I suppose he can vote for whoever he wants. But and that's the problem with the unlimited ballot. If you just, you know, allowed voters to vote for whoever they wanted, you'd have a lot more of those situations. You know, I think that's always going to happen, but I really believe that the process is pretty good. You know, compared to even other Hall of Fames and other sports, the way they're done. Like the football one is very political. It's one guy from each city, and they all kind of try to state their case, and it all depends on who was their pal, you know, whatever. And I used to be a football writer, so I understand that process. To me, doesn't work at all. So I think, you know, when you have 571 voters or whatever, I mean, people are going to look at a little bit differently. And I know that people think that the Hall of Fame should direct the voters, especially on the steroid issue, et cetera. But I don't agree with that. I think each voter should vote on the steroid issue as we are now, whether you believe they should be in or should not be in. I don't think the Hall of Fame really should get involved with dictating to voters how they should vote on, or the process in which they should vote on those matters.
Yeah, totally agree. And the football is crazy. It's only six players, and you can only vote one per position or something
right.
like that. It's so let's move on to some of the players here. You voted for John Smoltz. He got 82%. You know, I think most people would agree that he's worthy of being a first ballot Hall of Famer. But Mussina and Schilling combined didn't get as many votes as he did. And when you look at their resumes next to each other, they're all very, very similar. So why do you think that John Smoltz is the one who gets in, and, you know, Mussina is still in some ways struggling, not necessarily struggling to stay on the ballot, but he's closer to being off the ballot than he should be. And as you mentioned that, you know, Schilling takes a spike, but he's still only around 40%. So how do you explain that?
Well, I explained it in that Smoltz was unique. You know, he was the Eckersley-type pitcher with the 200-plus wins, the 150 saves, and he played a tremendous role in the postseason with 15 wins. And he's a guy we just saw perform at a very high level in both roles, so I think he's a unique guy. And that's why he's ahead of those guys. And there's been a logjam of pitchers the last couple of years with Lavin, Maddox, and Pedro, and Randy, and, you know, and Smoltz. So I really believe that Schilling and Mussina will eventually get in. I really do. And I have not been able to vote for either one of them. I desperately want to, but just haven't had the space on my ballot to do it, because I'm loyal to certain guys. I've always been loyal to Alan Trammell. And I'm not about, you know, even though he was, you know, far away from getting in and always has been, I still vote for him every year. You know, I'm not going to take my vote away from him just because I don't think he's going to get in. So, you know, I think now with four guys, you know, gone, I just think they're going to come to the forefront of pitching. As we look at pitchers, they will really gain a lot of steam, and I think the advanced metrics on both of those guys have really helped them. I think those who really promote the advanced metrics have made a great case for both guys, especially with the ERA plus, which is a great determinant for me as how effective a pitcher is over the course of his career. And I think those things are going to come to the forefront next year.
Yeah, good points there, Nick. And, you know, Schilling, obviously, you know, has the memorable stuff as well, the bloody sock moment, and the postseason resume is ridiculous for him. So I'm a little confused why, like, the old-school type people wouldn't go for him as well as the new-school people. It doesn't make much sense to me. But, you know, moving on to... go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, I think the old-school people, and I'm kind of a little bit of both. You know, I think the win totals are still big with the old school people. I think, you know, the fact they weren't that close to 300 wins. I mean, Messina had 270, so that's getting up there. But I think that's changing, though, as time goes along, as we realize that pitchers now of that era, you know, had bullpens behind them, that they were specialists that had to come into the games, and some of those games were lost as a result. So, you know, so that's changing, I think, a little bit. As we have more information on the advanced metrics, I think it's going to help those guys.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned Alan Trammell. Can you briefly say what you think the voters are missing with him? Because I agree, he should be a Hall of Famer, but he hasn't gotten barely any support for a long time now.
You know, it's really hard for infielders, you know, and I pointed out Jeff Kent before. And, you know, I guess we, as voters, look at these guys a little bit differently when they're infielders. I guess we compare them to, you know, Cal Ripken or whatever. I mean, you know, Trammell was, not only was he a good offensive shortstop, but he was a very good defender as well. So I you know, and the other guy, his teammate, Lou Whitaker, was dismissed so quickly, you know.
Yep.
And I thought he was a guy who should have been on the ballot a lot longer and a guy we should have studied a little more into because he had a great career as well. So I really don't know what people are missing from him. To me, he was always right there with Barry Larkin, for instance. You know, certainly I think he was comparable in a lot of ways, and I think Trammell was a better defensive shortstop than Larkin. So I don't really understand it. I never have.
Yeah, I guess some people perhaps look at the offensive numbers for Trammell and Whitaker and some other players of that ilk and, you know, aren't overwhelmed by him because, you know, if you're comparing him to a first baseman or, you know, anyone at the corners, basically, it's not, you know, super strong, but you have to consider position.
Well, and another position, I mean, look at what happened in the vote. Carlos Delgado, who had, 10 consecutive years of 30 home runs, doesn't stay on the ballot. I mean,
yep.
That to me is crazy, but I understand it because there just wasn't enough room for people to put him on the ballots this time around. So I was glad to see Gary Sheffield got, you know, 11.7%, so he can stay, and I think his candidacy will grow over time as well when people start appreciating the type of hitter he was. He was a devastating hitter. And I think he'll gain some ground.
Yeah, agree on Sheffield. Nick, get you out on this question. Piazza and Bagwell have both struggled in terms of getting elected, obviously. Looks like Piazza has a good shot next year, but Bagwell is kind of languishing there. So, I mean, what do you think? It seems like the main reason why these guys aren't getting in is because of steroid suspicion. So what do you think? I guess it's one thing when you have a guy like McGuire or Bonds or Clemens when it's, you know, more obvious. What do you think of guys withholding their votes simply on suspicion?
I don't get it. And listen, I've come 180 degrees in this myself. I mean, I was at the point where I would never vote for a steroid guy or a guy suspected of steroids. And in the last 2 or 3 years, I've just come around to actually saying, are these guys Hall of Famers or are they not? You know, even the stats aside, I watched Clemens for 13 years with the Red Sox, and I knew he was one of the greatest pitchers who ever played the game. And I knew that Barry Bonds was one of the greatest hitters I ever saw. Whether they took steroids or not, they were great. You know, they were great before they took them. They were just great players, so I understand that. McGuire, I never felt that way about, and I never voted for him because I think he was pretty one-dimensional. I just don't think, even though he had the numbers, I just never thought he was a Hall of Famer. So I do take it, you know, case by case. But with Piazza, you know, I mean, again, it's the same thing with Jeff Kent. It's just great numbers for that position. I mean, some of the best numbers ever. It's really hard to ignore what a tremendous hitter he was. He should be in, and he will get in, I think. I think Buster Olney is the one that pointed out today in a column that, you know, it should help other guys suspected of steroids once Piazza gets in, or even the steroid guys like Bonds and Clemens. I fully expect those totals to go up over time. Whether they go up enough to actually get in over that 10-year period, I don't know. But I do believe that those numbers will rise starting next year.
Yeah, and I'm really hoping that I don't think it's going to happen, but at some point, a guy who's actually in the Hall of Fame admits that he used steroids. That would really, I think, change the game to some level. But, Nick, we greatly appreciate you coming on. Before we let you go, what do you have going on at the Boston Globe? And you can give out your Twitter.
Yeah, Twitter's at Nick Cafardo, all one word. And, I write the Sunday Notes column every week. And there's always some good stuff in there that good fodder for, what's going on in baseball. So hopefully you pick it up. It's usually on the MLB trade rumors if you don't go on the BostonGlobe.com site.
All right. Great, Nick. Again, thanks a lot for coming on. Greatly appreciate it, and have a wonderful night.
Thank you. Take care, guys.
You too. All right. Good stuff there from Nick. Let me try to get Jonah Carey on from Grantland.com. So another quick break here, and hopefully Jonah on the other end.
Baltimore Sports and Life is dedicated to the analysis and discussion of the Baltimore Orioles, the Baltimore Ravens, and the University of Maryland. The site has a team of writers providing coverage of those teams and houses live streaming content weekly. Join the conversations at the message board, like BSL on Facebook, and follow BSL on Twitter. BSL is part of 24/7 Networks with Russell Street Report and Utah Street Report. The Baltimore Animal Rescue and Care Shelter, or BARCS, is a nonprofit organization created to take in homeless, neglected, and unwanted animals. BARCS grants refuge to over 12,000 animals annually, and staff works tirelessly to give each animal another chance at life. Donate online at BaltimoreAnimalShelter.org or mail a check to BARCS, 301 Stockholm Street, Baltimore, Maryland, 21230.
Welcome back to Sports Tonight with Rob and Mike. Mike Weber here with Rob Shields. We are now being joined by Jonah Carey from Grantland.com, one of probably my favorite sports analysis website. And Jonah, you are one of my very favorite writers, so thanks a lot for joining the show tonight.
Oh, thanks for the kind words. I really appreciate it.
No problem. And, of course, you are also the author of the best-selling book, The Extra 2%. As well as more recently, Up, Up, and Away, the story of the Montreal Expos. So people should check out those books. Jonah, so Hall of Fame results yesterday. We have, four, I think, deserving candidates. And I read your article. I know you feel they're deserving as well. Randy Johnson, Pedro Martinez, Craig Biggio, and John Smoltz. So what do you think of this Hall of Fame class?
It's great. It's one of the first of all, it's one of the largest Hall of Fame sizes in a long time. In fact, it's the largest since 1955. Just getting three in at once is a big deal, and four, like I said, the first time in almost 60 years. So that's great. Actually, exactly 60 years. So that's terrific. And in terms of the quality, I mean, these are all-timers, no question about it. Randy Johnson, I wrote a whole piece about him in December. It was, the piece where I selected my who I would vote for if I had a ballot and kind of went through all of it. But it focused on Johnson, and in my opinion, he's the best left-handed pitcher in the history of baseball. If you think about Koufax, he had kind of a shorter peak. If you think about Warren Spahn, he has Johnson in wins, but really in nothing else. Really, the only comp that I could think of is Lefty Grove, and now you're getting into stats from the 1930s, which is a whole other ball of wax. So, yeah, Johnson right there with the all-timer. Pedro, maybe the best peak of any pitcher of all time. That 1999 through 2001 period especially was just completely off the charts and incredible. Smoltz, a great member of those terrific Braves teams during that period in the 90s, and of course the early aughts, along with Glavin and Maddox, and well-deserving. And Craig Biggio, who absolutely has the resume. If you're a traditionalist, you would point to 3,000 hits. And if you're more of a sabermetrician, you would say his all-around game and playing up the middle positions and playing a tough ballpark in the Astrodome make his credentials very worthy.
Yeah, and as a Expos fan, are you a little – are you happy – I mean, obviously you're happy with Randy and Pedro getting in, but Is part of you, like, thinks back and, like, gets bitter about them trading those two players? I mean, imagine, obviously, if they were at the top of that rotation for years, and I'm sure you have imagined that.
Yeah, well, here's the thing about Randy Johnson. I'll try not to go too long, but, you know, first of all, I don't really have much allegiance to him because they traded him pretty much right away. He wasn't in that close for very long, less than a season. That is the only trade, other than 2002, when it looked like they might be contracted, but it's the only trade in which, at the deadline, they ever really went for it in franchise history. They traded Randy Johnson, but Randy Johnson was a very wild pitcher. He, you know, had good fastball and all that, but he couldn't find the play with him, you know, to save his life. It was really just a rough situation at that point. They didn't know how good he'd be. In fact, the best guy in that trade, the Expos thought, was getting Gene Harris, who was a hard-throwing right-hander who, you know, subsequently went on to do basically nothing in the major leagues. Johnson blossomed only years later with Seattle. Even his first few years in Seattle, he wasn't that good. It took a meeting with Nolan Ryan to really turn around his career. But the guy they got in return was Mark Langston, who at that time was the best lefty in all of baseball. He was right there with Clemens and, you know, a couple other guys as the best pitcher, period, in the game at that point. It was a real go for a trade. Langston was terrific with the Expos. He just ultimately became a free agent and went somewhere else. But, you know, it's the kind of trade that the Yankees or the Red Sox or a team like that would make, and the Expos finally made it. So, yes, Johnson turned into this great guy, but I try not to go too much with hindsight here, and I just say, listen, at the time, they had a real shot. They were in first place when they made the trade. They got a great pitcher. It didn't work out in the end, but this is the opposite of the normal Expos thing where they trade away a great pitcher and they get prospects. In this case, they were trading prospects to get a real superstar.
Jonah, let's get into the process of things before we get into some of the individual players. If if they came to you and asked you for what your thoughts were on how they could change the process of the Hall of Fame, are there any changes that you would make, and if so, what would they be?
Yeah, just two, really. I mean, we could kind of, well, I guess three, really, if you think about it. So, number one is the ballots should be made public, all of them. Right now, only about one-third of voters, or just over a third, make their ballots public. It's the person's choice, obviously. Now, some of it has to do with, you know, let's say that you write for the, Boston Globe. Okay, well, the Boston Globe, you have a job, you have a column, you could just put in your column, say, here's my guys, you can write a whole thing about it. If you wrote about baseball in the past, but you're retired, you still have a vote. They don't take votes away from you, really. So if you're 75 years old and you're retired, but you once covered baseball and you have a Hall of Fame vote, you might not have an outlet to let people know who it is you're voting for, so that makes it a little more difficult to be public. Having said that, there should be some sort of clearinghouse, either on the BBWA website or wherever, where people can see everybody's ballots. I do think that would make people more accountable, and then let's say they didn't vote for Randy Johnson, which is crazy, or Pedro Martinez, which is crazy, they would at least have to put their name next to it. And that would, I think, improve accountability. So that would be nice. Number two is the ballot limit of 10 is ridiculous. I'm a member of the BBWA, not a voting Hall of Fame member, but I am a member. And I said it on the meeting last month. And the vote right now, what we're trying to do is raise the ballot limit from 10 players to 12 players. Even I think that even that isn't necessarily enough. I think ultimately, without worrying about a number, just make it a yes or no binary vote. Is this guy a Hall of Famer? Yes or no? You're not comparing Jeff Bagwell to Frank McGriff or John Smoltz to Pedro Martinez. You're just saying, does this guy deserve to go in the Hall of Fame? That's what I'd like to see. And the third thing is I'd like to see some consideration given to whether or not the person is an active baseball writer. I just mentioned that there are people that, you know, might be retired for 10 or 20 years and they're still writing about it. I think most infamously, every year you can find three different writers who publish very, you know, good columns, and they talk all about their ballots and so forth. They're Hall of Fame voters. They work for a website called GolfersWest.com. They are actually golf writers and have been for a long time. Used to be baseball writers in the 80s and the 90s. I am not so sure that I want necessarily people who haven't even considered baseball for 15 or 20 years looking at the game and really having the same impact with their votes than Tom Verducci or John Heyman or Ken Rosenthal or Buster Olney or Jason Stark or somebody who really just lives and breathes baseball and can speak not only to the past but also the more recent past and even the present and the future when it comes to baseball.
Yeah, we actually were just speaking to Nick Cafardo, who was telling us that, you know, he was in on that meeting and talking about the going from the 10 to the 12. And Nick didn't like the idea of an unlimited ballot because he said, you know, because then you get – because one thing I brought up is we saw Hal McCoy say he voted for Aaron Boone because he thought he was a really nice guy. In so many words, that's basically what he said. And something like that is, you know, that's a pretty absurd vote. And Nick was worried that you would see more and more of that type of stuff if you had an unlimited ballot. And he thinks that in most years you're not going to even be able to vote for 10, much less 12. But the thing about the golf writer, it's interesting that you bring that up, because last year around this time we had Richard Justice on our show, and he brought those guys up. Just thinking on how ridiculous that it is that they have. I mean, one of the things that really bothers Richard Justice is you have guys who don't step foot into a press box. They don't watch a game. They don't cover the sport anymore. And here we're trying to get these guys to vote for this exclusive club. And it really bothers them. But I did feel that when we asked Nick Cafardo that a few minutes ago, his response was, well, how do you take it away? How do you decide it? He said, you know, I know some guys who are retired and still have their vote, and they're still very much involved in watching the game and everything else. So how would you personally draw that line on who should have their vote taken away and who shouldn't?
Yeah, that's a tough one, and I don't have an easy answer for you. I think that would have to become something of a subjective process, and you know, maybe what could happen is that the people that, you know, and there are committees on the BBWA, and there's a Hall of Fame committee. Maybe there could just be contact between the head of the committee and, you know, the people who have votes, and you know, maybe it could come to the point where they have a conversation. And I wouldn't say that you shove someone out the door necessarily, but maybe you have a conversation and you say to the person, "Listen, I mean, you haven't covered baseball in a while, and you're a football guy now. What do you think about it?" And there could be some sort of agreement reached. But it is tricky. There's no question about it. And like I said, I mean, I'm making up my requests, but that doesn't mean that there are easy solutions. I think, you know, changing the ballot size and making votes public, those are much easier to do in theory anyway. It's not a subjective versus objective thing necessarily. So I think that's in play. By the way, to the point about, you know, the unlimited ballots and Darren Erstad and all that, here's the thing. If Darren Erstad gets 10 votes instead of one, that doesn't make any difference whatsoever. Darren Erstad's still not going to the Hall of Fame. He's not even going to get the 5% to stay on the ballot. But if somebody has a very full ballot, or, you know, has a very full roster of qualified players and looks at it and says, oh, I have to decide between Jeff Bagwell and Darren Erstad. Jeff Bagwell, in my opinion, is clearly a deserving player. And the person says, well, I'm on the fence about Bagwell. I love Erstad as a guy. I'm going to vote for Erstad. That's the problem. The whole point of the unlimited ballot is that if you do vote for Erstad, it doesn't make a difference because you're not taking a vote away from somebody deserving. So I think it's the opposite point of, I think it was, you said it was Nick Cafardo, whose work I respect, by the way, but I disagree with him on that. I think that it's a no harm, no foul situation if you vote for Erstad when you have unlimited spots. It absolutely matters when there's a year when there were about 15 deserving candidates, as I feel there was this year, and Darren Erstad or Aaron Boone or somehow, or whoever somehow gets on the ballot.
And if you were a Hall of Fame voter, which, by the way, I think you should be, and this is, goes to kind of
obviously
that same thing, that there are plenty of people, writers out there, you know, yourself, a guy like Tom Tango, for example, you know, who don't
Keith
have
Law.
Votes and are much more into the game, and they should have votes. And, you know, but that's part of the issue there. But what would your stance be on the PED guys?
Well, I write a column every year just assuming that I do have a ballot, and I make clear that I would put them all in if they have the credentials. A few reasons. Number one, you know, their numbers are in good standing. It's not like they've been stripped of those numbers. They still exist. Major League Baseball didn't void the home run record or whatever, so that still exists. Number two, I'm convinced that the PED culture is much more widespread than people believe. It's not just Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens. I believe that more than half of the players in Major League Baseball in that era at some point dabbled in something, because that's what it was. It was, everything was readily available. If you talk to players in that era, I talked to one guy who played for one particular team back in 2001, and he estimated that 20 out of the 25 guys in the clubhouse probably took something at some point. And, you know, and you know, there were stars on that team, but there were scrubs, and everybody did it. It was just one of those things. So now you start getting down the road of trying to figure out what to do. Do you vacate the entire era? Do you say, well, you know, there's a good chance that everybody tried it at some point, or a lot of people did, therefore nobody gets into the Hall of Fame? I think that's a little weird. If you've been to the actual museum, first of all, the room that has the plaques of the inducted players, that's a very small portion of the Hall of Fame. There's a lot of other stuff. But even beyond that, if you get to the plaques themselves, you know, there would just be this giant gap for 20 years, which is really weird. If you really want to get into it, you could say on the plaque, you know, whatever, this was during the period of blah, 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 when steroid use was pervasive. If it was somebody who was actually caught or admitted to it or whatever, you could put that on the plaque. I don't have a problem with that. I just think that baseball history is really weird if there's no Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens on it. Clemens is one of the two or three best pitchers ever, and Barry Bonds is the best hitter since Ted Williams. I think it's just kind of head in the sand stuff if you just say, oh, well, this happened and that happened. I guarantee you, without a doubt, first of all, there's definitely amphetamine users in the Hall of Fame, including Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and Mike Schmidt, but I guarantee you that there are multiple steroid users who are already in the Hall of Fame. Guaranteed.
Yeah, I would say double digits, very likely. So, yeah, totally agreed with you, Jonah. And obviously I agree that you should have a Hall of Fame ballot as well, and then, like, a guy you referenced in your...
9 years to go.
All right, not only nine. So, you know, great writing and, you know, actually putting a lot of thought into this. Only 9 years to go. All right, well enjoy that wait. But, yeah, Jay Jaffe, who you referenced in the Grantland article where you actually put your hypothetical ballot, he doesn't have a vote. Or nope. I'll even get crazy and reference a non-writer. Brian Kenny probably is a guy who I would say should have a vote.
John Thorne,
yeah.
Vin Scully, Bob Costas. You could go on and on. There's a lot of people who should have voted.
Well, I mean, I like Bob Costas, but I don't know about his – with the Hall of Fame ballot he would produce, I wouldn't be a huge fan.
Bob Costas,
but anyway.
Bob Costas is a Tim Raines supporter, so that's fine with me. He can do whatever he wants.
Yes, you have that. I'm not a fan. Anyway, you have Curt Schilling on your hypothetical ballot, along with Mike Mussina and John Smoltz.
Yep.
Rob and I, you know, we're Baltimore guys here, so we're biased towards Mike Mussina, but it's very confusing to us and you know, to a lot of people that John Smoltz, in his first year on the ballot, gets in easily, and he had more votes than Curt Schilling and Mussina combined, and you can even throw in McGuire and Sosa's vote totals, and you still don't get this John Smoltz's vote total. I mean, can you really explain that? Can you help us out, figure out why that is?
Yeah, my colleague Ben Lindbergh actually wrote an article specifically addressing this point, and he felt there were a couple of reasons. Number one was sort of the coattails thing, where you have this halo effect of Maddox and Glavine are in, and Smoltz is in. I think that might be part of it. But I think the second one is the bigger reason. And by the way, I think that Smoltz is a deserving candidate, and I'm not saying no. Mussina and Schilling are as well, is my point. All three of them should be. But I think the thing that made Smoltz a more popular pick was this whole idea of 250 wins and 150 saves, or 200, whatever it was. I couldn't tell you how many wins anybody has, nor do I have any idea who wins the RBI title or the batting title these days. I honestly have zero idea, because those stats don't matter to me. Anyway, Smoltz with whatever, 200 and 150 or 250 and 150, that impresses people. They say, well, he was dominant in two different ways. They have trouble with nuance. You know, Schilling and Mussina, well, they have about as many wins, but they don't have that saves, therefore Smoltz was better. You should be penalized when you have saves rather than wins, not rewarded, because it is easy to be a relief pitcher. I cannot stress that enough. Think of all the guys who have been dominant relief pitchers in Major League Baseball. Eric Gagne could not cut it as a starter, got injured, ended up taking steroids, which is a whole other thing, and became a dominant closer. Mariano Rivera, the greatest closer of all time, was a mediocre starter. They put him in the bullpen. Lo and behold, he was great. Jonathan Papelbon couldn't cut it as a starter. Billy Wagner couldn't cut it as a starter. Trevor Hoffman couldn't cut it as a starter. This is an inferior role. It is not supremely important to get the last three outs in the ninth inning. It is much more important to get the first 21 or 24 outs in a game. Mike Mussina is way, way more valuable than Mariano Rivera ever was. Mariano Rivera is going to skate into the Hall of Fame on the first ballot, and Mike Mussina is grasping in air. It's completely ridiculous, and it's just an idea of people really not understanding. And it's not even a complicated sabermetric thing where I could talk to you about war or whatever. Do you really not understand that 24 outs are more valuable than three? I'm befuddled by this. I don't understand it at all.
Yeah, and Smoltz, by the way, he had 213 wins. Mussina had
213.
And okay. that what you just said is kind of Mike and I's point. Let's just say Mussina and Schilling, in the middle of their careers, decided to have 3 years where they were closers. Do the voters not think that they could have gotten 50 saves a season and gotten 150 saves? I mean, you know, that's a big issue. I mean, and you didn't, you just mentioned WAR and you didn't really mention it, but Mussina, according to Baseball Reference, had a WAR of 16 higher than Smoltz. That's like four really good years. And, you know, one of the things that Nick Cofardo was saying is, you know, some of these guys, the old school guys, you know, they like to see that 300 win total. Okay, Mussina had 270, so he fell just short. So does that mean if Mussina hung on for a few more years and had, you know, two, three, four mediocre years and was able to get to 300, that all of a sudden he's now a Hall of Famer, but he wasn't before then? I would love to know, like, what the different criteria is. But I think you're right. I think people look at the closer position as this, you know, difficult position that, you know, those are the hardest three outs in the game, and every game is at the end. And, you know, because John Smoltz was so successful at it for 3 years, then, you know, that makes him a Hall of Famer. I he is a Hall of Famer. It's just, I just don't see the case over the other two as much as it's being shown on the voting results.
Well, to your point about the 300 wins, absolutely. If Mike Mussina went 10-70 in his last 3 or 4 or 5 years in the major, or sorry, 30-70 to get to 300, he would be in the Hall of Fame. And the example of that is Craig Biggio. Craig Biggio had a Hall of Fame-worthy resume 5 or 6 years before he retired. But I don't think he's in the Hall of Fame if he didn't really – he kind of sucked his last couple of years. If he didn't limp to 3,000 hits, I'm not sure he gets in. He's kind of in the Hall of Fame in a weird way for the wrong reasons. You know, just if you look at how good a player he was playing three up the middle position and, you know, being an on-base machine and all hitting all these doubles and being very durable and as good as he was playing in the Astrodome, no less, which is a tough hitter's park, he could have retired 3 or 4 years earlier. To me, he's a Hall of Famer. Nothing that he did in the last few years convinces me that he's Hall of Fame worthy. 3,000 hits is totally irrelevant to me. I mean, this goes to Raines, too. Tim Raines has 2,600 hits, so he's not in the Hall of Fame. Tim Raines walked 1,330 times. He reached base more times in his career than Tony Gwynn or Roberto Clemente, two of the most obvious Hall of Fame picks of all time. And yet they won't vote him in because he has, the way it is distributed, 2,600 hits and 1,300 walks. If you take, let's say, 600 of his walks and you make 400 of them bunt singles and you make 200 of them, let's exaggerate, triple plays, let's make them triple plays, he would obviously be a vastly, vastly inferior player, but he would skate into the Hall of Fame probably on the first ballot. It is completely insane to me how people think about baseball and they can't use simple logic. You'll notice I don't really cite WAR. I don't, in my columns, on radio interviews, I don't really do it that much because WAR is controversial and there's debate about defensive metrics or whatever. But if you can't understand how hits and walks work next to each other, if you can't understand that relief pitchers are less valuable than starting pitchers, I have no idea what to tell you.
Yeah, Jonah, if for some reason you listened to the show at some point, you know, about 45 minutes ago, I made almost identical point about Biggio and Mussina in terms of the end of the career. So totally on board there. Do you have time for one more question?
Of course.
All right, thank you. So I actually do – there's one thing I guess I disagree with you in terms of your ballot. So you listed Edgar Martinez as someone you would vote for if the ballot was larger. You didn't make your top 10. And I agree with Edgar being on there, by the way. So I'm not – no problem there. But my question is, why not Gary Sheffield, considering, you know, offensive production, just with the bat, I would say pretty comparable. Gary Sheffield's longer career, almost as good in terms of, you know, rate stats. So also, obviously, a superior base runner. And, you know, basically what hurts him, you mentioned WAR, is his historically terrible – advanced defensive stats, which at least on Baseball Reference and FanGraphs are probably exaggerated, which Jay Jaffe pointed out. Like, and I mean, just in terms of remembering him, I mean, besides his defense at third base, I mean, I don't know that people remember him as an atrocious defensive outfielder. But I mean, why not him? Why, I mean, I guess he's being penalized more for his bad defense, at least by the more progressive people, than you would penalize Edgar Martinez, who obviously didn't play much defense.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a fair point. Sheffield, to me, is right on the barrier, I guess, in some extent. And it's not as clear-cut for – I mean, it's not like Edgar is such a slam dunk, the most obvious pick either. I will say this, if you talk about on a rate basis, Edgar was a little bit of a better hitter than Sheffield was. Edgar by OPS plus – you can use WRC plus too, but let's just say OPS plus. It's a little bit easier to understand. OPS is just on-base percentage plus slugging, adjusted for home park if you're not familiar with that stat. Edgar's 147 and Sheffield's 140. So he is a little bit of a better offensive player to some extent. Sheffield did have more at-bats, obviously, so that might negate some of that gap. And certainly you mentioned that Sheffield stole a bunch of bases. I will point out that his net stolen bases don't really account for all that much. He stole 253 bases and was caught 104 times. So that's a really crappy percentage. It doesn't do much. He, I concede, will have gone from first to third and second to home more times than Edgar probably over the course of his career because he was a better base runner, especially when he was a younger guy. So, yeah, I do think those defensive stats come into play. It is complicated. It is difficult. You know, I think that ultimately I would imagine that my vote probably came down to Edgar with that slight edge in rate stats. The fact that he played in you know, in that Safeco Field for quite a long time as well, made it difficult for him. But if you want to argue for Sheffield, he's so close to the edge for me, and Edgar is really not that far above the edge, then I'm fine with it. I mean, I make the same point in the column about Larry Walker versus Jeff Kent. I had Larry Walker in and Jeff Kent not. If you said you want Jeff Kent and not Larry Walker, I really don't think I'm going to argue with you. And when you're that far down the ballot and you're talking about the 14th or 15th guy or whatever, I don't. It's not that I'm drawing a line. I mean, I am drawing a line in the sand because I'm deciding who I would vote for and who I'm not. But I'm not even going to bat an eyelash if somebody disagrees with me. And I'm not going to have the greatest answer either, because the differences are almost one of taste, and they're one of such small degree that you can easily make the case one way or another. There are certain guys that are close, but I can clearly say no. Fred McGriff, for instance, he did have 493 home runs, but if you just look at his, you know, his stats relative to his era, they're just not good enough. That to me is a guy that I could say, okay, clearly he's in. Whereas if you look on the other side, somebody who's, you know, maybe somewhat close to the line, but I'm willing to say yes, that's Biggio. That's about the right level there. Biggio was the 11th guy on my ballot, but good enough, I don't have a problem with it. If you actually disagreed with me, I'd argue with you. I think everything in between, you get to the Walkers and the Kents, and the Trammell, I think, to some extent, Edgar, Sheffield, you can go either way, and if you said yes and you said no, I just wouldn't put up much of a fight.
Yeah, that's fair. I guess my only comment about the rate stats would be kind of, you alluded to it, and it's kind of the anti-Biggio situation, is that Sheffield just, you know, if you take away, like, his early struggles that Edgar didn't experience, which is actually held against him by, you know, the old school people, but if you take that away, then the rate stats probably are just about equal, or at least very close to it, to Edgar. But, you know, either way, yeah, it's close. So, Jonah, you know, we've held you on here long enough. We greatly appreciate you coming on the show. You write for Grantland.com. You have an article up today. Last I checked, it was on, you know, right up front there on the website, predicting next year's Hall of Fame results. You also have the article we've referenced a couple times from last month that people should check out if they haven't already. You make the case for Randy Johnson as the greatest left-handed pitcher ever, and you go over your hypothetical ballot. And then, once again, people should check out your books, Up, Up, and Away, Montreal Expos, the story of them, and The Extra 2%, which is story of the Tampa Bay Rays and how they, on a very limited budget, went from worst to first. So, Jonah, anything else you want to mention, your Twitter or anything else before we let you go?
Yeah, Twitter is at Jonah Carey, J-O-N-A-H-K-E-R-I, and I appreciate you guys having me on.
We greatly appreciate you coming on. Thanks a lot, Jonah.
Cheers.
All right, you too. Have a good one. All right, Jonah Carey, great stuff from him. Appreciate him hanging on for a few extra minutes. So, Rob, we'll get into a few of these players that, you know, we've talked to Nick and Jonah about. Any reaction, though, from either interview?
First of all, I find it very difficult to disagree with anything that Jonah Carey was saying. I really don't disagree with much of what Nick Farta said either. The only thing I disagree a little bit, I think there should be an unlimited ballot. I think Jonah's point is correct, that you can vote for a Darren Erstad and it doesn't take anything away, you know, if you want to vote for him just for the heck of it or something like that. The one thing that I do think that they have to figure out, whether it's kind of a, you know, hey, you got to go because, you know, because it's a convincing argument, or, you know, it's some established rule, if you don't cover baseball for this amount of years, you're out, even if you're retired and pay attention. But I do think they need to figure out something about some of these writers, because, quite frankly, just some of these guys shouldn't have a vote. And this is not this is not an award, you know, that's just kind of BS. This is not something that is just, you know, who cares. I mean, this is a pretty prestigious thing. And, you know, as we've talked about, a lot of these same guys are the guys who vote for the Cy Young Awards and the MVPs. And, you know, you look back at Mussina, what I believe it was 2001, you know, he finished fourth, I think, in the Cy Young voting. And he was clearly the best pitcher that year. When you take the three guys who finished in front of him, and I think it was Clemens won that year, and it was like Freddie Garcia and Jamie Moyer finished ahead of him. And if you take their stats and you line them up next to each other and you don't put the name on there, there's no way you don't pick Mussina out of that group. and those same voters are the ones who are voting for the Hall of Fame, and those same guys will sit there and say, well, Mussina never won a Cy Young. You know, he was never part of a world champion. Well, okay, but, you know, he should have won a Cy Young. Just because you guys didn't know what you were talking about doesn't mean, you know, that he wasn't worthy of the award. And, you know, so it's bad enough you have those guys. But then when you add in the guys that don't cover the sport, that don't pay attention, and, you know, probably aren't intelligent or knowledgeable enough at this point to argue for or against certain guys, I mean, you can't tell me that a guy who hasn't covered baseball since the 90s can give you a logical argument about Jeff Kent if he hasn't really looked into his career. He can't do it. It's not like guys who've covered the game a lot of them aren't giving you logical arguments for a guy like Jeff Kent. Now, Jeff Kent is a borderline guy, you know, but he certainly is involved in the discussion. Whether you think he should be in or not, you know, that's debatable, but he's involved in the discussion. And those guys continue to have votes, and something has to be done about that. So, you know, it sounded to me like Nick Cofardo felt that something should be done, but that it shouldn't be a pushed out type scenario. And I understand why he says that, especially since a lot of these guys are his friends. You know, these are people that, you know, they've been his colleagues for years and years and years. But you know what? Something has to happen, because friendships are not, this goes obviously much more beyond, you know, just a friendship that you have with a writer, and you think it would be a disservice to that guy to push his vote out. But there's got to be something that's got to get done there, because the process is certainly an issue. I don't think the percentages are too high that they're asking, and, you know, I don't think a lot of the things, and when you compare it, like he brought up the football thing, the Football Hall of Fame voting is a joke, how that's done. So it's way better than that. But again, what does that mean? I mean, who cares? If there's a process that is terribly flawed and your process is just a little less flawed, then that doesn't necessarily make it, you know, that doesn't mean that you don't change it just because it's better than something else. So they definitely have to look into this. I'm glad that they're getting guys in there who deserve to be in. I mean, we had the Jim Rice and the Andre Dawson, who, you know, those guys really shouldn't have been considered, you know, for as long as they were, much less get in. And, you know, so at least we're getting in guys who are really worthy candidates of being in the Hall of Fame. But, you know, still, the process has got to get fixed.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, I, you know, pretty much agree with everything you said and what Jonah said. So I don't really want to belabor that point. I am excited that Jonah, like I said during the interview, basically made the exact same point I did earlier in the show about Mike Mussina and Craig Biggio. So that was nice. Jonah Carey ripping me off here with the arguments. So let's talk before we end here. Talk about a few of these players that we haven't really gotten into that, you know, are on the ballot that missed out. You know, obviously Piazza and Bagwell, we're for those guys. I think pretty obvious cases. The steroid suspicion is holding them back, which, you know, is ridiculous, like Nick Cofardo said. And I think Bagwell is just an underrated player regardless of the steroid situation, because he doesn't, you know, have the totality of numbers, like, you know, kind of like what Jonah was saying. Like, if you hang around and what I was saying earlier again, was if you hang around and suck for a few more years, if you get to, like, 500 home runs or 3,000 hits or whatever, then you get in the Hall of Fame or, you know, whatever it is, 300 wins. So, which is just really dumb. So, Jeff Bagwell only has 449 home runs, but he was a fantastic player. He was a great all-around player for a first baseman, very good defense, and a very good base runner, at least first half or so of his career. And, you know, he had a injury that ended his career early, which you can say about Carlos Delgado, by the way, as well. And he would have a lot more support if he got the 500 home runs, even though he wouldn't be any different of a player. But I think that's also what's holding Bagwell back, is for a first baseman, his counting stats are not overly impressive. And then Piazza, like we were talking about with Nick and like Alan Trammell, Lou Whitaker, you have the situation where some people, I think, clearly do not properly adjust for what position guys play. And they just, like, put their numbers up and go, all right, no 500 home runs, you know, no 3,000 hits, that's not that great of a hitter. Like, and obviously Piazza's whole case is hitting, basically, besides that he played catcher, because he didn't play catcher particularly well. So you look at his counting stats and, you know, 427 homers, 2,127 hits. You know, if you're comparing that to a first baseman, not Hall of Fame worthy, but you look at the rate stats and you compare it to catchers, he's the best hitting catcher ever. You know, except for potentially Josh Gibson, which you can't really, it's hard to compare there. So those two guys should be no-brainers to me. I assume you feel the same way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think people realize, I mean, you know, Bagwell had a career OPS of 948. I mean, that's tremendous. You know, his OPS plus was, you know, in the 160s. I mean, you know, and like you said, I mean, this is a guy who was a good defensive player. He wasn't just a, you know, he wasn't just a bat. Now, you know, I don't think that there's any question that Albert Pujols is going to go in on the first ballot, okay? And he should, okay? I'm not going to sit here and argue that he shouldn't. You know, Albert Pujols has a career OPS of almost 1,000. He has, you know, over 500 home runs. You know, he was a good defensive player. You know, he's excellent. But, you know, Bagwell's career OPS plus is 149. But, you know, I think, you know, looking at a guy like Pujols is exactly the problem. For some voters, in like you said, in regards to Bagwell, because, you know, when you're a first baseman, they want to see the 550 homers and they want to see the 2,000 RBIs and things like that. I mean, that's what they want. But, I mean, you know, Bagwell, 408 all-time on-base percentage. I mean, this is a guy, you know, he didn't, you know, I want to say Andre Dawson was somewhat like 320-ish or something like that in on-base percentage in his career. A guy made, you know, he was an out machine. And here he is. Well, you know, it's not even a comparison. I mean, Bagwell has a career WAR of just under 80. I mean, I think if I remember correctly, Dawson was like in the 40s or 50s or something like that. I mean, I'm like you. I don't like to get into this. Well, if this guy's a Hall of Famer, then this guy has to be, because then you start letting in like Brady Anderson as a Hall of Famer compared to, you know, some of the guys that they let in the, you know, from the early years. But, you know, Dawson is a recent guy that the voters said, you know what, this guy deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, how can the voters that were voting for Dawson not look at Bagwell and say, yeah, this guy's a Hall of Famer too? I just don't understand it. And Piazza, you know, the ironic thing about Piazza is this is a guy that both new school and old school guys should be voting for. I mean, as you said, I mean, pretty much he's universally thought of as the greatest hitting catcher ever. You know, that's, you know, going back to Mike Greenberg and saying, well, close your eyes, is that guy a Hall of Famer? You know, if that's the argument that you want to use, which we both agree is poor, then how can you not say, yeah, Piazza's in because of that? Now, Piazza's going to get in, and like you said, he's probably going to get in next year. But, you know, when you close your eyes and you think, okay, greatest hitting catcher ever, how can you not put in the guy that you think is the greatest hitter at his position in the history of the sport? I don't understand that. It doesn't make much sense to me. You know, and the fact that it's in all likelihood based solely around back knee and, you know, things like that because they think that they did steroids is a joke. And, you know, I mean, the justification from these writers over this kind of stuff, you know, many of these writers remind me of the umpire who shows up the other team because, you know, with the thought of, well, you know, the crowd is here to see me. No, they're not. And these writers are the same way. You know, they think that the fans are you know, we're watching these votes because we care what, you know, Buster Olney has to say or something like that. So I'm going to sit there and I'm going to make a stance and blah, you know, and all this kind of stuff. No, it's not. Your job is to put in the guys that are Hall of Famers, you know, just like what Jonah Carey said. Who do you think is in the Hall of Fame? Nick Cafardo, you know, he was a guy, he said, you know, he didn't vote for the steroid guys in the past, but now it's kind of like, do I think they're Hall of Fame? Yes. Okay, I'm putting them in. And that's exactly the way it should be. You know, it's not a, you know, it you can say it's not fair for you or me or somebody else to sit there and dictate to these guys how they should vote. But, you know, this isn't, you know, deciding who you think is the president and, you know, and saying, well, you know, I don't think that you should vote for that guy because of this. Well, that's different. This is a performance based job where, you know, a vote where you vote on them from their job based on the performances and what they were able to accomplish. And for these guys to sit there and have this high and mighty attitude over some of this stuff is a joke. And it's just, you know, it's a little disheartening because, you know, this is the same argument that we have every single year, and it's just not going to change. And I it's sad because, you know, it just leaves so many guys out of the area that they deserve to be in.
Yep. Yeah, it's ridiculous. The sad thing with Piazza is if he decided to wear a shirt like all the time in front of reporters, I guess he would be in the Hall of Fame right now. I don't know. You know, his mistake, obviously. We're going to just punish him because he didn't wear the shirt. What a dumb decision on his part. And you know, the character clause is the main thing I guess the voters obviously cling to here. But they only cling to it when it's convenient to them. They obviously have dismissed it countless times in Hall of Fame voting history. Andre Dawson, by the way, you know, our baseball reference war is 64.5, which is, you know, puts him on the third line. The on-base percentage, I think you got right, is 323. He did have 1 year where he hit 49 home runs, by the way. No other year above 32, and the years surrounding it were 20 and 24, and this was 1987. So that's the type of year where if you're going to get suspicious about steroid use, yeah, that would really stand out to people now, but because he's more the old school guy, and most of his career happened before, or like at least most of his prime happened before the quote unquote steroid era. I guess no one's going to care about that. So let's get into a couple more players here before we finish up. Jonah Carey mentioned, I think one of his favorite players, in part because he's an Expo, and Jonah Carey has the Expo book, a huge Expo fan. Tim Raines. So, you know, the same argument is brought up every year. His times on base is, like, basically the same as Tony Gwynn's. Very, you know, very similar player if you look at it in that way. And then, you know, Gwynn had a little bit more power. Obviously got on base more based on batting average and than walks. But then you factor in that Raines is the greatest, like, person in terms of stolen bases really ever. I mean, he doesn't have as many steals as Henderson, so you could say second best maybe, but his percentage is ridiculously good. So, you know, the case I think is pretty strong for him. You count all the steals and then that would, you know, add to his slugging percentage, obviously. So you're on the pro Tim Raines side, right?
Yeah, I mean, he should be in. I mean, it's funny that Jonah mentioned the Tony Gwynn thing, and it seems like that's the guy that a lot of people like to bring up when comparing him. You know, but I think what Jonah said is 100% right. Take away some of the walks, make them hits, give him 3,000 hits, and all of a sudden he's a Hall of Famer. It doesn't matter the fact that he would still be getting on base the same amount of times. It's that, you know, he found 400 more hits that found green as opposed to just getting a walk. I and again, this is why the whole debate about the old school, new school thing, it drives me crazy because, you know, getting back to Bagwell. Bagwell is a Hall of Famer because he did a lot of things really well. As an old school guy, you should appreciate the fact that as a first baseman, he could run the bases. He wasn't just some blumbering fool out there. You know, he could catch the ball. He could play defensively. You know, a guy like Tim Raines, he didn't sit there and try to, you know, slap at hits and try to pull everything and try to do things just so he can have the glory of a base hit versus the walk. He did what he needed to do for his team to get on base. You know, those things matter, and they should matter, and they should matter. I don't care if you're an old-school guy or a new-school guy. Those things should matter because those things help you win baseball games, and that should be the whole purpose here. So I don't get it. Jonah is 100% right, though. If he had 3,000 hits and 700 walks, he'd be in the Hall of Fame right now. And, you know, he'd have the same on-base percentage, the same everything, basically. And he might even actually have a worse batting average. It's actually likely that he would. You know, he brought up the triple play thing. You know, if he hits into more double plays, hits into triple plays, you know, causes more outs for his team and stuff like that, that wouldn't have mattered. What would have mattered is that he had 3,000 hits. And it's, you know, that, look, 3,000 hits is a heck of an accomplishment. I'm not trying to downplay what 3,000 hits means. It is. You've had a long career. You've been a successful hitter. Everything else. It's an impressive feat, but it's not the end-all, be-all of statistics. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of these guys think it is.
Yep. that's pretty much the way it is. You know, just mentioning Craig Biggio, since you mentioned double plays, you know, that's part of the reason why he's deserving is because he hit into very few double plays, you know, and that's something that people don't really pay much attention to. He also got hit by pitches, you know, a ton. He was like a league leader pretty consistently or close to it in that regard. So a couple underrated things there for Craig Biggio. You know, Sheffield, I mentioned him to Jonah. He's a guy I'm kind of, you know, getting more interested in because, you know, you don't have a, he got like about 10%. He's not someone who is, you know, talked about a ton. And if you look at WAR, it's not good because, you know, the defensive stats are ridiculously bad. I don't think he's like the third worst or second or whatever worst defensive player ever. So, I don't know, have I... I know you didn't put him down on Baltimore Sports and Life as a guy you would vote for or, I guess, consider vote or vote for even if the ballot was bigger. So did I make any impact there?
For who?
Sheffield.
Yeah, no, I actually think I have to go back and really study Sheffield. I think I would put him on. I remember looking at his statistics last year because I think when we did the Hall of Fame show, we talked about where he would be you know, we're looking at next year's ballot. I don't know. I if I had an unlimited ballot, he'd be on there. If I had a ballot of 15, I'd have to look at it. I'm not 100% sure if he makes my ballot of 15 or not. I would guess that he would, but he would be somewhere as player 14 or 15. So I think that he should get in eventually. I do think that, you know, the years at third base with the poor defense and, you know, because he wasn't good there, and he was a guy, I think Sheffield is penalized because he's a guy who came out, he was supposed to be the, you know, he was the best prospect, you know, he was coming up with Milwaukee, everybody thought he was going to be, you know, so great and everything else, and he didn't do anything early in his career. And I just think that so many people remember that Gary Sheffield and not the Gary Sheffield that he became. And it's almost as if they're holding it against him that he didn't come out of the gate and just dominate. Now, and you combine that, because they did think that he would do that, and you combine that with the fact that, you know, did he take steroids or not, and then you get the people say, you know what, he's not a Hall of Famer. I really think, and that's how crazy it all is, and that's how stupid it gets, because people, and that's why, getting back to what Mike Greenberg said, you can't sit there and just say, well, yeah, that guy's a Hall of Famer because I close my eyes and I see that. You have to look at statistics and you have to look at what he did, because I think when you do that, some of these guys are just like I won't lie, if you had said to me 5-6 years ago, you know, is Tim Raines a Hall of Famer? My first thought would have probably been no, but then I would have had to, but my next thought would have been, well, I've never really looked at his stats, so I don't really know. And, you know, he came at a time where I was, you know, yeah, he, you know, a little bit of the tail end of his career, but, you know, at the best years, I wasn't, you know, I was too young to remember, or I wasn't watching the sport or whatever. So I would have to look at that. But you know, you ask, you know, if there's a baseball writer our age out there that's voting, and he never saw Tim Raines play, and you just say, is he a Hall of Famer, and he hasn't looked at his stats, his answer is going to be no, because he's not somebody that is looked at as an all-time great. You know, same thing, Alan Trammell is another perfect example of that. So, I think that that's really what happens with people, and I think they get into these things, like what I was saying about Sheffield, and I think that's why they don't vote for him.
Yeah, and by the way, if you close your eyes, do that stupid test there. Sheffield, I think he passes that test.
I would agree.
I think he's, you know, everyone pretty much can picture him at the plate, wiggling the bat. He's talked about all the time as, like, one of the greatest bat speed guys ever. You know, he was a tremendous hitter, one of the most feared hitters in baseball. By the way, in terms of your, like, comment in terms of his early career, I mean, he came up, he was a 19-year-old late in the year, I guess. At age 21, he had 116 OPS plus, which is pretty good. He struggled the next year. But at his age 23 year, I mean, he was third in MVP voting. About a .330 with 33 homers, and, you know, so he got good pretty quickly. So, yeah, and then, you know, the new school, old school thing, that drives me crazy. Like, because, again, I think it's – I don't know what old school is a lot of times because, you know, Tim Raines stealing bases, great base running. Isn't that old school? I mean, that's what I believe is old school. And then that drove us crazy with the Mike Trout MVP conversation. Is Mike Trout should be old school defense, base running, you know, batting average, and getting on base. You know, I mean, that's playing center field, playing at an up the middle position. Isn't that old school? Anyway, everyone, thanks for listening. Had a good time here talking about the Hall of Fame. Maybe we'll be back next week. Not sure. You know, Rob, actually, his wife is expecting a baby. So congrats on in advance there, Rob. And, you know, again, thanks for listening and have a good day.